Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. I'm speaking to you from my hotel room at Gen Con 50 in Indianapolis, Indiana. If you're here, I look forward to seeing you at the One-Shot Annual Network Fan Panel on Saturday at 7 in the Crown Plaza in Pennsylvania Station B, and at the fan hangout afterwards at 8 p.m. in the Trevi Marzio room at the JW Marriott. And if you're not here at Gen Con, that's okay. It's like we're hanging out right now. My guest today is Jessica Hammer. Jessica is an assistant professor at Carnegie Mellon University, jointly appointed in the Humored Computer Interaction Institute and the Entertainment Technology Center. She is also developing a live-action game with friend of the show Mo Turkington called Rosenstrasse. This game is based on a real historical event, the Rosenstrasse protests, which took place in Berlin in 1943, and in which the non-Jewish wives of Jewish men used relentless public demonstration to successfully prevent their husbands from being sent to Auschwitz by the Nazi regime. It's a game about feeling the grip of fascism tightening around you and the people you love over the course of a decade, and where you, the player, are taught and get to practice the skill of looking that evil in the face and saying, no, this goes no farther. I thought it might be interesting to talk about. Typical day for you kind of consist of? I know that you're supervising people, and also I think you're teaching as well.
Yeah, so as an assistant professor, I guess faculty, right? That doesn't matter so much based on your rank. I would say four major areas of responsibility, and some of those are common across all faculty, and some of them are actually kind of specific to my role at CMU, which is to be somebody who unifies research on games with the practice of game design. So area one is research. So I actually I study games, not just role-playing games, but games of all kinds. And my appointment is actually in a human-computer interaction department, HCI, which is hosted within the School of Computer Science. So one of the things I'm really interested in is how technology changes the way that we play and what we can learn about designing games that uses new technology in innovative ways. So, for example, one of the projects I'm working on now is looking at Twitch and other kinds of streaming services and what technologies can be used to make those more participatory in terms of gameplay. So there's a push now to make these streaming services kind of more like TV. You sort of watch these large channels that everyone else is watching. And I think people are actually using game streaming in some really interesting ways that fall outside of that paradigm, like to create communities, to advocate for their favorite games. And I'm interested in thinking about what happens if we let audiences, for live streaming audiences, be more participatory in gameplay. What kinds of new game design spaces does that open up? So you can already see that this is research that's directly engaged with the practice of game design.
Yeah.
The second area is teaching. So I actually, I'm in two different departments. One of them, I supervise PhD students who are going to probably go on to be researchers, though I think some of them are considering going to the game industry. And I also teach in a professional master's program. And one of my emphases is thinking actually across both programs about training new game designers, not just people who are necessarily going to go into the game industry full time, but training people to make games as part of an expressive practice or an artistic practice, or even just as a fun hobby that they enjoy, as well as training people who are going to go on to work in industry in various capacities. I'm expected to participate in what's called in academia service to the community. Mm-hmm. So in my case, that means thinking about how do I apply my research to issues like making game design more inclusive. And finally, I'm expected to be a practicing game designer. So part of unifying research and design means getting your hands dirty and really thinking about the craft of game design as a craft, and trying to instantiate the research in designs, and also taking insights from the design process and using that to inform the research questions that I try to ask.
Interesting. It sounds like you're keeping an eye on a really, really broad range of communities of design, right? Like, there's so much happening across digital and like role playing and board and, you know, what's getting called folk games right now. How do you sort of keep track or keep an eye on so many disparate communities?
It's a great question. And that's actually something that I really struggle with. I even before I became a professor of game design, I did not have enough time to play games. And now I really don't have enough time to play games. One thing that I've tried to do to address that is actually build a community within my research lab. So I have, in any given semester, I am actually leading basically a small company, you might think, right? A small institution within CMU. In a typical semester, I might have like 25 people working with me. So one thing that we do is we try to share our knowledge. So different people become experts, deep experts in different subdomains. And then we know, oh, well, if you want to talk about, you know, technology for augmenting tabletop board games, right? There's someone in the lab you can talk to about that. If you want to talk to someone about tabletop role-playing games, there's someone you can talk to about that. So we really think about how do we split up the work within our community so that we all get smarter together.
It sounds like there's a very intentional kind of cultivation of like lots of people whose interests are somewhat aligned, but also somewhat different.
That's right. When I talk about my sort of educational mission, you know, what I say to my students is that my goal is to help you find the work that only you can do. This is something, you know, especially for people who struggle with imposter syndrome, there's this idea that you have to do the right work and that someone else defines what that right work is and what the right way to do it is. And I see my role as a teacher and a mentor as being more about developing the person that is already there. That might mean exposing them to a whole bunch of different research topics or game design ideas to help them identify directions that are going to be productive for them. It might mean me helping them translate something that they care a lot about into language that's going to make sense to stakeholders who are going to be important for their future career, right? There are a lot of different ways that I do that. But what that does is people come to me because they're interested in a set of themes. And within those themes, I encourage and support people to find their own expressions or instantiations of those themes. For example, game design for transformation, right? Games for, or what we call games for impact sometimes. How do games change their players, right? A lot of different kinds of problems you could approach, but we share design philosophy and a way of creating these kinds of interventions and studying the way that games change people. Or certain genres of games, or ideas about power and redistributing power. And what that means is because everyone's responding to the same set of themes, you end up with these really surprising connections between different students' research projects.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading this paper that you contributed to that was about health games. So games that either encourage you to exercise or games that are for folks who need to track diabetic-related information or smoking cessation games. That was actually trying to tease out what about these actually works and what about these actually doesn't. Can you share with our listeners the kinds of things that show up when you're doing that kind of research?
Yes. Yeah, so maybe I'll take a step back and just give you a little bit of my philosophy in approaching this idea of transformational games, which is that I think games actually always change you because you are still your full self. You always bring your whole self to playing a game.
Yeah.
And you always walk away from the game with the experiences that you had in the game that happened to you. Now, You know, there are sort of theories about the magic circle and ways that things that happen in the game are not there. Jesper Juul calls it half real, right? Sort of real, but also sort of not real. Maybe you have permission to act a different way. But those are things that predict the way that you're going to behave in this game experience that might be different from the way you'd behave in a different context. But you still walk away from the game saying those things happened, right? And I have an interpretation of what they mean to me. Mm-hmm. So what's really lacking, I think, is any kind of systematic understanding of how games change people, that we can't really predict it. And that's what my work and the work of my colleagues in this field is trying to do, is to say, how do we make games that have a more predictable or more reliable impact on their players, where, first of all, that it's going to target the thing that the designer hoped to target, and that it has an effect that lasts beyond just the time that you're playing the game. It's not just kind of like, oh, well, you know, I played this game and now I feel more cheerful, but the game was actually trying to teach you about medieval history.
Sure. Yeah.
So one of the sort of research concepts that I would say there are two major research concepts that I'm engaging with right now that guide both my research and my design. The first is this idea of alignment, which is that when you are designing a game that you are hoping will be transformational in some way, that you want to be thinking about not just what it is you want the game to accomplish and what are the mechanics of the game, but actually really to be matching, right? That the way that the game system works should align with some kind of proven sort of psychological mechanism for creating change. And that mechanism should be aligned with mechanics, and it should be aligned with narrative, that sort of all these different factors in the game should be working together rather than at odds. And that may sound really obvious, but it's actually a pretty sharp rebuke to sort of a previous approach to primarily educational game design, though I think also very common in games for health, which basically used gameplay as an incentive, right? You know, eat your vegetables and now you can have dessert, right? Do this math problem and now you can, you know, do the thing that's actually fun about the game. So this concept of alignment is basically saying that what's fun about the game should be the thing that you want to be transformed, right? So if you're making a game about engaging with history, then the history should be the pleasure, the meatiness of the game. That should be the thing that people are spending their time on and spending their emotional energy on. If you're making a game that's about, you know, getting people to be more physically active, then it's not like, oh, well, I'm going to be physically active and that gives me enough currency that I can do something fun. It's that the physical activity itself should be the fun and the joy and the thing that people are being motivated to do. Scott Nicholson talks about this. He calls it playification in contrast to gamification, which is finding the play in the activity itself and making the activity joyful instead of trying to add game structures to it in kind of a externalizing way.
Right. And so this is very exciting to me as someone who gets either irritated or outright furious at the idea of just like, we'll take this boring thing that people hate, but we'll put badges and XP on it.
Yep.
And then it will be a good time.
That's right. We have there's a shorthand for that in the research community. We call it PBL, points, badges, and levels.
Oh.
And, you know, and there are people who actually spend their careers studying PBL. Yeah. And there's some good reasons from the motivational research to think that, you know, PBL is actually pretty good for certain kinds of tasks. So if you look at the research on intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, you find that people have very different motivational structures for example, tasks that are tedious versus tasks that are difficult.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, I should have looked up the names of the papers, but I'll try to give you the executive summary. So there are a bunch of researchers, there's a community of researchers who look at this idea of intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, which they sort of conceptualize as the idea of the reward is you internalize it and experience it as part of the activity or consonant with the activity, versus the reward is perceived as separate from the activity. So for example, there are people who look at this in the workplace, where they look at, you know, people's willingness to persist in a task when they get money for completing the task versus when they have some sort of sense of the intrinsic value of completing the task and they get a reward related to that. So it turns out that points and levels and badges and these kind of markers of progress are quite good at helping or the research suggests that, I should say, because I don't think that particular study has been done yet, but research on other kinds of tasks suggests that that's the kind of feedback that helps motivate us to basically do more of a boring task that we don't want to motivate people to do outside of the context in which they're getting rewarded, right? Hmm. So do you need to put stamps on 100 widgets? Points may actually help you put stamps on 100 widgets.
Okay.
But when you get into tasks that require sort of creative thinking or problem solving, then putting extrinsic rewards, which is how sort of points, badges, and levels are often experienced, it sends the message that this task is not valuable except for what you can get out of it. And people will actually engage less, do it less, and tackle less difficult challenges, especially after the rewards are withdrawn. So they've done a lot of these studies with incentive programs for kids to read more. And one of the big challenges for these programs is that when you say, I'll give you a pizza every time you read 5 books, you get kids saying, I don't care about the reading. What I want is pizza. And this is actually a game design problem, right? I mean, the people who are doing this research, they don't have game designers involved. This is like classic psychology, motivational research, some of it's being done in education. But, you know, it gets back to this concept of alignment, right? The pizza is a misaligned measure. It's a misaligned reward because it actually overtakes and dominates the thing that you're really trying to do, which is getting kids to read more.
It also sends a pretty clear message. Like, the design of that experience sends a message that reading is not very valuable. It's so invaluable, we have to force you to do it. It is so boring that we have to construct this thing where you get a pizza at the end in order for you to even consider doing it.
That's right. And, you know, and here's the other really interesting problem with it, is it actually doesn't really address the problems of why kids don't read. So, there's a game studio here in Pittsburgh that focuses on making commercially available transformational games. And they are in the process of developing and releasing a transformational design framework. And one of the things that they do is they help you think through what are the barriers that people face, right? And the barriers that people face around reading, that kids face around reading more, aren't, you know, nothing good happens if I read a book. Right. That's not what stops them. You know, there are all kinds of other incentive structures that are set up to reward kids who do read. So for the kids who don't read, just saying, let's give them more incentives, but this one will be pizza. It's just really not thoughtful design. And that's actually one of the things that sort of I work on, which is this question of, you know, you've got to pick a good problem and articulate it in the right way and really understand what are the barriers to change? And then you can think about whether and how to target them with the game. If you don't articulate the problem clearly, then what you end up with is a game or intervention that may target the problem that you thought you had and doesn't solve the problem that actually exists.
There's kind of a, you know, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail thing. How do you, as a game designer, figure out, is this something that is really, like, is it time for a game right now? Or is this really
a great question.
Much different problem that I should really leave to somebody else?
I will tell you that I have actually been invited onto projects where they said, you know, we'd like to solve this with a game. And what I have said to them, you know, after 6 months of user research and trying to understand the problem better, what I've said is actually a game is not a good solution for this, right?
Ooh, how does that go down?
Well, I think it actually speaks really highly of CMU that the response was, great, so explain why and how do we pivot?
Okay.
And I don't think that's something you would see everywhere. But, you know, that's often my job is to kind of come onto projects and say, you know, you think that making this a game is going to accomplish something, but A, is it the right something? And B, can a game actually do what you want, right? So I think people who don't have game design training have a lot of misconceptions about what games can do, both positive and negative, right? So they have this fantasy that I'll make it a game and then everything will be fun, or like the thing that I want to be fun will just magically be fun because I called it a game. But they also, I think, often don't think about the breadth of ways that games can make a difference to people. So, and this is actually getting back to the paper that you looked at, is one of the things that we were trying to do in this paper is to illuminate for the context of Games for Health why there's a gap between, what is the gap between what game designers know and what health behavior researchers know? And are people who are trained in Games for Health successfully bridging that gap? And what we found is there are actually really quite large differences that I think go a long way to explain why some areas of games as interventions are actually really underexplored, despite the fact that people are desperately trying to shoehorn games into problems where they don't make any sense.
Okay, give me an example. This is very interesting.
So one of our really interesting findings is that there's a lot of research in health behavior change around the importance of emotions, what researchers call affect, in successfully changing health behavior. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that when you ask health behavior researchers to talk about games, emotion drops out of the picture. They don't think about it in the context of games, even though it's highly present in all of the behavioral design theories that they use to create other kinds of interventions. And when you look at, there's studies basically show that health games do not instantiate health behavior change theories, right? Like there are these theories that are validated and that people have spent a lot of work putting in about good ways to design health interventions, and then people go to make a health game and all that just disappears. You know, there's always some really exceptional exceptions, but for the vast majority of what's out there, there's no theory driving the design of games, and therefore you're sort of just shooting in the dark and hoping that your game is going to make not only a difference, but the difference that you wanted it to have.
Yeah.
And you're also hoping that it's good enough that anybody's going to bother to play it, which is, believe me, not an assumption you can safely make when you're looking at almost all transformational games. You know, what I tell my students is that making transformational games, you know, it's more than twice as hard as making a game that's not transformational and making an intervention that's not a game. That it's not just about mastering two different sets of skills, but there's actually a lot of really difficult research to master and also design judgment to develop in how you meld them.
Yeah. And you have to think about, like, what are you competing with too, right? Like, even if, you know, the people that you're trying to reach have access to your game, you're still competing with Candy Crush. Like, sorry, but...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, so really interesting, actually, because, again, there are weird opportunities that I think are not, not everybody realizes, which is that transformational games actually offer an excuse or an alibi for adults to play who may not otherwise have social permission to play.
Aww.
So I'm not playing this game because it's fun. I'm playing it because I'm training my brain and I don't want to get Alzheimer's.
Oh,
there's, yeah.
Right.
There's a really good paper by a very recent paper by Sebastian Dieterding, where he actually taxonomizes a bunch of these approaches of these alibis that people use to make excuses for why they are adults, but they still get to play. So you might or might not be competing with Candy Crush, but you need to be taking that into account in the design process.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I was part of a research team. We made a game that was designed to help people stop smoking. And almost everything that's out there, almost all the tobacco reduction games are aimed at convincing people that they should stop smoking, in which case you really are competing with Candy Crush, right? Like, who's going to sign up to be lectured to when they could be playing a game that's actually fun?
Who's on the fence about whether or not tobacco is bad for them? And they're like, well, maybe I'll download this app.
Yeah, exactly. But so we looked at the research, and actually the vast majority of smokers, about 70% of adults, at least at the time we did this research, actually, the numbers may be slightly different now, of adult smokers want to quit, and about 40% try to quit every year. Wow. So these are people you don't have to persuade to play. Like, if they think your game is going to help them quit smoking, like, oh, I can, you know, quit smoking and have fun instead of just have it suck. These people are already highly motivated, and you're not competing with Candy Crush anymore. You're competing with a cigarette.
Yeah.
So we used that as the design insight to create this game, that we made a game that used biofeedback to basically be, this game is fun, and it'll give you the same physiological and psychological, it'll meet the physiological and psychological needs that are driving you to smoke. And we did a research study with our game. And by the way, if you ever want to know what bureaucracy looks like, try to get ethics board permission to get someone to smoke a cigarette as part of a research study. But we eventually got the permission. So, well, we got the permission, and we were able to, we did a whole bunch of psychological and physiological measures, including like skin conductance, heart rate, EEG. And we were able to compare what happened to people when they were smoking and what happened to people when they were playing our game. And what we found is that the game was not as intense as smoking, but it had the same physiological and psychological effects. And also people reported that they had fun playing and they wanted to play more. So what we're competing with in that case is the moment of, oh, I should pick up a cigarette. No, actually, maybe I'll play this game because I know I'll feel better afterwards. I won't want that cigarette as much, and it's going to be fun, and it's going to take my mind off the fact that I really want to smoke.
Yeah.
So it's meeting people where they are and meeting a user need, like a human need, not what I, the person who's saying, quit smoking, you know, not what I think you need, but rather what you, the player, think you need.
Tell me more about this game. Like, what did it actually entail? What was it called? How did you sort of deliver it to people?
So the game is called Lit to Quit, and it was a breath-based biofeedback game. So we based it on a validated method for smoking reduction, which is called breath therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And in breath therapy, you basically use a variety of breathing techniques to reduce your urge to smoke. The problem with breath therapy is that it's so boring. Outside the lab, nobody does it. Right. In the lab, amazing results. In the field, just people don't, right? They're just like, whatever, I'm going to spend 5 minutes breathing funny. So what we did was we basically created a game that was an excuse, like an alibi, for you to do breath therapy because you weren't huffing and puffing because you wanted to. That was like, I need a cigarette so badly, I'm going to do this, you know, funny breathing thing. But no, I'm doing it because the game is going to make me. So we had two modes in the game because there are two reasons that people smoke. One we called rush mode, so people who smoke to kind of get pumped up. And in this game, you're controlling a spaceship. You're trying to pick up different colored targets. And periodically, you encounter a black hole, right, as you're flying through space. And the only way to escape the black hole is to open a wormhole, which you open by hyperventilating into the phone's microphone. So, yes. So during playtesting, we actually had several people pass out from hyperventilation.
Okay.
But
this is why you playtest.
This is why you playtest. So, we realized we needed to kind of do some calibration and tuning. So at the beginning of the game, you do some breathing, and then we calibrated the number of breaths that you needed per minute in order to open the wormhole. Turns out hyperventilation has a lot of the same effects as smoking a cigarette to kind of get your heart rate up and get pumped. In relax mode, so people who smoke a cigarette when they want to kind of chill out or calm down, we did structured deep breathing. So basically in, hold, out, hold. And We did this by having you blow a little sort of spark. So the goal was your spark was, you had a star that had fallen to Earth, and you were trying to blow it back up into space, which was the theme between the two games, mm-hmm. right? That you were flying through a star field versus mm-hmm. helping this star return to the sky. And so because you were sort of blowing in long, gentle breaths, that people's heart rate still went up, which is the physiological effect of nicotine, but they felt much calmer. And so that game met their needs for using cigarettes to relax.
Oh, wow, that is so neat. And so great to be able to integrate those two things as well.
Yeah, well, it was a great project, except that it ran into the sort of problem that I think a lot of research projects have, which is it works great in the lab. We got really good results when we interviewed players. And we published some papers, and then, you know, the team all moved on to our next research projects. So the funding and the publication incentives of academia, right, the things that help me keep my job, they don't always line up with, sort of widely distributing or commercializing games. And one of the things that I really appreciate about CMU, one of the things that makes the job I'm in now kind of a dream job, is that they actually really value, first of all, field trials, so understanding how games operate in real world context. Not every institution does. They have some of the infrastructure you need to do that kind of thing. And also they've really encouraged me to think about releasing, publishing games, submitting games to award competitions as actually part of my job description. And that as long as I can show that I'm successful at it, which is its own sort of source of stress, right? But as long as I can show that I'm successful, that's actually a valid thing for me as a researcher to be doing. So as long as I can kind of line up the funding, if it needs more than just me, my institution has my back on the value of getting games to real players in a real ecosystem of play.
Well, and that makes perfect sense to me, because I feel like there is like data that obviously needs to be collected there about like, okay, but what do people actually use? How do we change this such that people actually find it, use it, whatever?
Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
But not every school and not every department values that. It's one kind of knowledge. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, there are other ways of knowing. And so I'm just lucky that there's a fit, that that's something I think is valuable, and also that that's something that my institution thinks is valuable. I think a lot of sort of game designers in academia get a little stuck. They kind of have to do it on top of their day jobs, mm-hmm. as opposed to being able to say, no, this is actually a valid part of my day job.
Yeah, this gap between design and publishing is just strangely, it's been this recurring theme in Backstory for the past little while for some reason. And people are trying to figure out how to make these things hold hands because for some reason they don't talk to each other that well, which seems really counterintuitive, but I don't know. So thank you for adding another piece to that puzzle.
Yeah, you got it. Well, it's interesting because for me, of course, publishing means two different things. That there's publishing the research findings and there's also publishing the game itself. Mm-hmm. And, publishing research findings is one of the key metrics for what I do, right? It's one of the things that is, you know, when people want to know, are you a successful professor? What have you published? Where did you publish it? And what impact has it had on the research community? But publishing games, there isn't as much of an infrastructure. And one of the things that I think game programs are now really starting to address is what do sort of peer-reviewed systems for game publishing look like, right? There's an enormous sort of social and institutional infrastructure around publishing academic articles, right? So I get asked to review articles. I agree to review about 12 to 15 a year. I probably get asked to do 30.
Wow.
And that's time that I volunteer to making the process of peer review and academic publishing work, because it benefits all of us if sort of, you know, everybody bangs on the can of knowledge. But there's no process like that, not within academia and not really as far as I can think of outside it, where there's any kind of expert peers evaluating whether or not something should be published, and if it shouldn't be published yet, sending it back and saying it's not ready for prime time, right? I think a lot of those decisions get made sort of by editors and publishers, but I think that there's a different sort of system of, there's a different set of ideas about what's good or valuable, what's feasible, whether you're making decisions based on what you think will advance the state of knowledge. So maybe your game is crappy, but it does something really new. That might be worth it, right? Or maybe your game is crappy, but the insights that people get out of playing it are actually really great. Or maybe your game is fantastic and it's totally not commercially viable. That's actually something that can be successful in an academic game publishing context. And there are some people who I think have really good partial solutions to this. So for example, Mary Flanagan's lab up at Dartmouth, Tilt Factor, has a really beautiful like internal design process where they test and validate games and sort of surface up the ones that are relevant for research, and then they partner with a company that a spin-off company run by many of the same people that does commercialization. So you're not trying to say this has to be research valuable and commercially viable,
yeah,
but that there's actually two different lenses from which to evaluate games. But I think that we have a long way to go. And I think that when these kinds of things start to get built, I think it's going to be a value for the academic game design community, but I actually think it's going to be a source, an engine of innovation for game design as a whole.
There's also an interesting intersection between commercially published games and a sort of academic research interest. You also contributed to this paper on using the game Treehouse Dreams to elicit interview data from children. And that's like the most exciting thing in the world to me on so many levels. I'm interested in how that comes about. Like, at what point does someone say, hey, there's just this game and I kind of like it and it's interesting. Maybe we should figure out if it has a purpose, or I have this idea that maybe it might have this in some way verifiable use. Like, how did that kind of come together?
Well, I think that what you've hit on is actually an ongoing, I wouldn't even say debate, but just something that the game research community is always talking about, because there's pros and cons between using what we'll sometimes call like commercial off-the-shelf games, COTS, versus designing your own game, in terms of like, if you're using a commercial game, you don't have to be a great game designer. You just have to be a great researcher, right? Finding great researchers who are also great game designers is actually like, that's hard.
Yeah.
So, and if it, depending on the how widely the game is released, you may actually be able to get like large scale data that you could never do with your game unless you happen to hit it big and have your game be incredibly commercially successful. So there are a lot of very good reasons to study commercial games. But on the other hand, you have to figure out if they're aligned with what you're trying to do, rather than being able to say, well, here's the problem and I'm going to design something that's perfectly targeted to it. So that's actually one of the things that brought our attention to Treehouse Dreams, is that it actually kind of hit a sweet spot between commercial and custom, in that the larger structure of the game was defined, but we could actually create new cards. So we actually worked with the designer to get like a custom card so that we could put our own text into the game, because we were trying to collect data about some things that went over and above what was already in the game. So we pulled out a bunch of stuff that wasn't relevant to us, but we were also able to insert stuff that was. So that's one of the things that really made me notice Treehouse Dreams. But I think that, you know, in general, this is, you know, calling back to something we talked about before, you need a certain amount of game literacy to even be aware that there's a game that exists that might help you get at a problem that you're trying to solve. And this is why I am trying to develop a game literate community here at CMU, and we have some real strengths in that area. But also, when I train game designers and game researchers, I mandate play, which is a very weird place to be, right? But every week in my game design classes, you have to go out and you have to play some games, because you need to understand what kinds of design problems people are grappling with, what are the solution spaces they've discovered, and also you just need to understand what's out there so that when you say, gosh, I have this problem, you have the ability to draw from the world of games in the same way that you would draw from the research literature, right? To say, oh, well, there's a paper that's relevant to this. I want every student of mine who goes out the door to be able to say, oh, there's a game that's relevant to this, whether or not they decide to use it in their research. You know, Treehouse Dreams, I think, had some things about it that made it a really, really good fit. But that awareness has to be the first step. Yeah. And, you know, that's why developing methods for researchers to play and designers to play broadly is really important. And I'll just say one more word on broadly is I think it's very easy for people to converge on a set of kind of canonical games that they think are important in any one genre. Mm. And it is important to think about, you know, what are the games that everyone else will know. But as a researcher, or if you're trying to innovate in game design, your instinct should be to go away from what's extremely popular and to say, what else is out there? What don't I know about? What isn't going to come into my sphere just because other people are talking about it? And there are a couple of ways that you can do that, but this is one of the explicit motivations, the way that I tie commitment to diversity and inclusion in game design to the practice of just being a better game researcher and being a better game designer. Mm-hmm. That when it comes to people just randomly happening to talk about a game in your hearing, there are a whole bunch of systemic and structural reasons why games by people who are marginalized in some way, right? Particularly, I'm familiar with the research on gender and race, but mm-hmm. I think it happens along other axes as well. Those are going to be games that are better than their level of popularity would suggest, and where you are likely to discover something that nobody else has understood yet. And so you should be aggressively seeking out games by not just by designers who personally happen to be marginalized, but designers who are in communities of designers who are developing new languages of design that are happening outside, you know, this sort of constructed, I'm doing air quotes here, right? Like quote unquote mainstream, where, you know, real games are the ones that are made by men, aimed at men, right? Made in ways that reflect white culture. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that use these invisible defaults and that probably are more likely to be in your face and are likely to be in your face more than their merits necessarily warrant.
Yep.
Which doesn't make them bad games, right? It just means that they're mm-hmm. likely overhyped. And you want to be looking for games that are undervalued if you want to see where the innovation is and where the interesting research is going to happen.
Yes. And I think that piece around innovation is so important, too, because chances are if something has gotten to the point where it's on a shelf somewhere or, you know, on the front page of Steam or whatever, like you say, in your face, chances are it's doing something that some other person did 5 years ago. And the person who did it then wasn't credited or compensated and probably came from a marginalized community.
Yep. Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't know about probably came from a marginalized community, but that's certainly how I see it play out a lot.
It seems to keep
researcher, researcher, look, I'm very cautious about claims of incidents, but I will say that I frequently see that. Doesn't mean that what I see is a representative sample. These are the kinds of things that, like, research training, you're just like, nope, can't say that. Even if I think it's probably true.
Haha, I'm a practitioner. I can say whatever I want.
Yes, you can. Good for you. Say it.
Good stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, because, and look, this approach, I think, flies, you know, directly in the face about this idea of meritocracy, that mm-hmm. like the best games will always be the most popular games, the ones that make the most money or the ones that rise to the top. Which of course, like, sort of reifies all these invisible things that are driven by, you know, systemic bias, unconscious bias, sometimes very overt bias. You know, so until we have sort of systems that are better at not sucking, right, when it comes to treating people in a more fair way. A good rule of thumb is basically just to run toward the thing that is being marginalized, because it will be undervalued by others, and you have the opportunity for intellectual arbitrage, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, you can be the person who sees its merits. And I think that comes with a responsibility, by the way, which is to elevate what you see, right? Is not to say, well, it's mine now. Even if you're a member of the same community, not to say mine, but to actually say, well, you know, one thing I can do is when I help people see the value of this thing that I've spotted, I'm going to use my voice and my platform to kind of say, and, you know, let's find out what this person might do next.
Yeah, yeah. And to share that and promote that so that when, you know, when it shows up in a AAA game 3 years later, you can all be like, it was this person.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, who knows what impact that has on them, right? Like, maybe they're not making games anymore. Maybe they've moved on to something else. But I think that, you know, we lose a lot by ignoring our intellectual heritage. You know, as someone who's a researcher looking at the way that discourse around role-playing games happens, it's like, you know, you have the same argument every, like, 3 or 4 years, and it never goes anywhere. And it's very hard to build knowledge. And I think a lot of the reasons knowledge doesn't really get built is because prior contributions get erased. People aren't always very good at listening. And, you know, and a lot of the people with the best ideas, especially in the past few years with the increased rates of harassment and, you know, threats, I think are only talking about these things. They're not talking about these things where they are, where they can be heard at a larger scale.
Yeah.
And I just think it's really bad for the future of role-playing games.
Yeah, it is. It sucks real bad, you know, that there are people who I think, for, you know, for example, would be really interesting to have on the show who are just not on, just not really kind of doing game stuff anymore, you know, or people who used to be publishing a lot, either, you know, maybe just on their blog or somewhere, and now they've kind of stepped back from that, and now it's a lot harder to hear what they have to say. And I would never hold it against anyone for getting the hell out of games or, you know, scaling back or whatever. But it's not a loss to them. It's a loss to the community.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and look, you know, I think twice every time I do something that puts me in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have definitely said no to things because I was concerned about my safety. I was concerned about, you know, what bad actors would do if I spoke up or said something. You know, I mean, there are things that I want to say right now that are, I mean, right, not even, you know, maybe that controversial, that, you know, there's a part of my brain that's going, are you sure you'll be safe saying that, right? Like, it can be dangerous to disagree with men online. That is, as a woman, that is my experience. And I had to, I just spent the last like 2 minutes debating whether it's okay to say that.
Which tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, that's right. And that's also 2 minutes that I was spending going, can I say this? And not, you know, here's an insight, you know, here, let me tell you about game research, or here, let me, you know, be working on a new game.
Yeah.
So
it really does consume a lot of energy to be doing that sort of like constant level of like background self-censorship.
Yep. And, you know, that's part of why I've put a lot of my energy into publishing in academic contexts, because look, let's be clear, academic peer review can be vicious.
Yeah.
I got a review on one of my early papers that was basically, I kid you not, it is evident that the author does not understand what they are talking about.
Whoa.
Right? And I read that, I was just, you know, it was like a knife to the heart. Yeah. It was it was very upsetting, but it's within a framework and it's within a context that, you know, they don't know who I am. I don't know who they are. There are people in the process in between us who in theory are actually supposed to help say, well, you know, they said this, but here's the insight for how to make your work better, right? Everybody here wants you to succeed and improve. And that is so different from the sort of discourse that I see it around games in general. I mean, not just role-playing games by any means.
Yeah, of course, of course. Gosh. I want to talk about a game that you're working on right now. Just a quick thing. What's one thing that you think that we could do to make our process of critiquing each other's games, which is often either completely absent or like absurdly vicious, to make it a little more useful in the mode that academic peer review can be?
It's a really good question. I don't think that I would adopt an academic style peer review without thinking a lot about what that would mean in terms of setting up infrastructure. So I'm going to limit this to kind of like an achievable change.
Sure, yeah.
which is, in my game design classes, I have actually developed a method for critiquing games that addresses some of the most common problems that I see with this kind of criticism. Mm-hmm. And I call it the IOTA method, which is experience, observe, theorize, advise. So, and I work with my students to actually break it down into these four steps. So the first thing that they do is, so we do this with in-class play tests. You ask people what they experienced, and only the people who played the game are allowed to talk, and they have to talk just about what they experienced, mm-hmm. not why they think it happened, not what they think you should do, just what did you experience when you were playing this game? Mm-hmm. And I work with the class to do some modeling, right? So I'll say, like, I'm going to stop you. You know, it sounds like you're sort of moving up to the next level. Let's just talk about what were you feeling at this moment in the game that you're describing? Then we do observe. So this is anything you noticed about what someone else was doing that's visible and observable, right? Mm-hmm. So I noticed that at this moment in the game, this person was smiling a lot. Next is theorize. Why do you think these things are happening? And only after you've gone through all of these steps are you sort of allowed to offer critique and critical advice. And this process, I have found, does a good job of producing critical feedback that has the qualities of high quality feedback. So how to give good peer feedback is actually one of my research areas. And one of my students and I are working on a digital system that for live peer feedback sessions, right? Mm-hmm. So we're looking at systems that can support this, but actually you can have non-digital things that people can implement today. So high quality feedback is critical, right? It's not just positive. Mm-hmm. It's specific rather than generic, and it's actionable. It's based on the scope of what the person is able to do. They could actually do something about it. And it is about the product and not about the person. And interestingly, in different social contexts, you end up with different kinds of problems with feedback. So for example, in design classes, some of the design classes that I've observed have a problem with people not wanting to be critical of their peers. They don't want to say anything that could be perceived as mean, even if it's a criticism of the work rather than of the person. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think that in the games world, criticism is often has no problem being critical, but is not actually about the work, right? It's about the person.
Sure.
And then is not actionable, or it's, you know, it's sort of, anyways. So I found that this process, the IOTA process, is really helps people slow down and not jump to the process of saying, here's what you should change, or here's what I liked or didn't like, because it separates their preferences from data that they observed from their hypotheses about what's going on. And if they take those three steps, my experience is, and maybe it's worth doing a formal study of this actually, that in the fourth stage, you then get much better feedback from peers. Yeah. So the IOTA process, I offer it to you and to the games community at large.
I love it. Maybe we will start doing some stuff like that around playtesting and see how it applies.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds really neat. Thank you for sharing that. While we still have some time and you don't have to dash, I want to talk to you about Rosenstrasse.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is this game that you're working on with Moira Turkington. It's going to be part of a sort of a new Warbirds line. I have a little like sort of summary here, but why don't you summarize it for our listeners?
Rosenstrasse is a game that follows the lives of Jewish Aryan couples. And again, I'm making air quotes. Of course, Aryan is a category that was constructed by the Nazis with the Nuremberg racial laws. Mm-hmm. It follows the lives of Jewish Aryan couples in Berlin from 1933 to 1943, culminating in the Rosenstrasse protests. During this period, Jews in Germany were perhaps obviously under threat, but Jews who were married to people who had the legal status of Aryans had a certain degree of protection. And that degree of protection varied by whether the Aryan member of the couple was male or female. So women who were married to Jewish men were actually quite vulnerable because the Nuremberg laws were not just racist, they were sexist. Mm-hmm. And the sort of man status predominated, while Jewish women who were married to men who were considered Aryan by the regime were sort of more protected. And obviously they were all more protected than families who were Jews married to Jews. Mm-hmm. So what this situation meant is that there were actually still Jews living in Berlin in 1943 because they fell into one of these sort of protected categories. And in 1943, the government decided, you know, enough of that, right? Mm-hmm. Who thought it was a good idea to have Jews still living in Berlin? Mm-hmm. And rounded up these Jewish men, right? Notice the Jewish women were sort of still counted as organized, mm-hmm. but the Jewish men were rounded up and taken for sort of processing to be sent to Auschwitz. And there were mass protests led by their Aryan wives. And so the game is the story of these relationships and looking at what happens to a marriage when it's being put under increasing stress by the restriction of civil rights, trying to help people understand what it feels like to have your civil rights restricted, and then culminating in asking the female characters, the players, every player has a female character. So these female characters going to protest the Nazi regime, right, which we sort of hold up as the ultimate evil. Meanwhile, their male characters, the men in the story, are under threat in various ways, and their fate sort of depends on the choices that the players have made during the game, including standing up in the Rosenstrasse protest.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's amazing about this event is that it's not only an incredible thing for people to have done, but also, like, it was successful. Like,
right.
They did it. They released those Jewish men, and they were protected and not sent. They were, like, literally saved their husbands' lives by doing this, by an act of resistance. And as someone who, like, I thought was fairly well-read on the Holocaust, I'm both embarrassed and angry that I had never heard of this before hearing about the LARP of it. And so I think just straight-up transmission of knowledge that for some reason I have not been exposed to is an inherently good thing. But, you know, we've been talking a lot about very specific goals and specific design choices to achieve those goals, and having a more specific goal than just transformation in a broad sense. So tell me about some of your goals that you and Mo are working on with Rosenstrasse.
So I think we have sort of goals on a few different levels. I think at the most basic level, you got it exactly right when you're talking about transmission, that just people should know about this. And they should know about this in part because it's an intervention into sort of the typical Holocaust stories, including, you know, it's not sad dead Jews, which, believe me, plenty of stories about sad dead Jews, but it's a different way. It complicates our understanding of what it means to be Jewish under the Nazi regime. And it also complicates the stories we have about sort of non-Jewish heroism, right? That in fact, there's a very interesting tension around this game and around the protest, which is, you know, these women stood up. They were successful at getting their husbands released, but they also didn't stand up until it was their husbands. And one of the things that we're trying to hit on an emotional level in the game is that moment of realization of like, oh, wow, okay, all of a sudden I feel angry that no one stood up for me and simultaneously feel shame that I never stood up for anybody else, right? And that moment is part of what drives some of the characters in the experience of the protest. We've been pretty successful at getting that sort of moment to hit for our players. Mm-hmm. I think that there's also a goal around changing people's attitudes around civil resistance. So Erica Chenoweth has some superb research looking at civil resistance versus violent resistance to oppressive regimes. And the long story short is that, civil resistance is far more effective. So one of the things that we wanted to do was to show that even when there's this incredible disparity of power and you wouldn't think that civil resistance could do anything, it can. So one thing we could look at, we haven't run research studies around the game, but one way you could look at that is basically to understand, talk to people about what they think is the efficacy of protest, right? How effective is protest likely to be? Under what circumstances? And in our post-game debriefs, people have said things like, wow, I can't believe anyone stood up to the Nazis, right? They're seen as this ultimate evil. Well, if the Rosenstrasse protest could discomfit the Nazis, maybe my protest matters too. So that, I would say, is a second transformational goal. A third transformational goal is giving people a chance to practice some of the skills of protest. So in the third act of the game that's set at the Rosenstrasse protest, we actually ask people to face these imaginary situations where, for example, an armed soldier is telling them to stand down or back down or go away. So they get to sort of imaginatively practice some of the things that real protesters have to do, albeit in a much less dangerous and fraught situation.
Yeah.
Finally, we want to start conversations about activism and protest. It turns out that one of the biggest determinants of whether people get involved in anti-oppression work is whether they know other people who do it. So even if all we're doing is introducing you to other people who think protesting oppressive regimes is a good idea, that's actually a pretty big intervention all by itself.
Wow. This sounds amazing. So how is development going? Where are you and Mo at with this project?
It's a great question. We put together what we're calling the quote, festival edition of the game, which we've submitted to some game design competitions. And we're using that to get sort of playtest feedback and figure out what we need to iterate. Our goal is to have a standalone version of the game, ideally sometime this fall. And we are also thinking about how the game can be facilitated for people who are outside the role-playing community. Mm-hmm. So from a game design perspective, we're in the middle of doing things like changing the wording of some of our scenes, figuring out what order things go in. We realize there is a scene that probably needs to be written that actually can come up and we don't have a scene written for a particular situation. Mm-hmm. So we're doing some sort of game design cleanup, changing things that we've learned from playtesting. And simultaneously, we're working on things like instructional design, because we see this not just being played by role players, but actually it's being run at a synagogue actually this weekend. And we've had a number of other synagogues get in touch with us to use this as part of their Holocaust education programs. At this point, we can do it. But if someone's not doesn't know much about role playing, we can't actually just hand it off and expect someone to be successful. Another context where it might get played is Holocaust museums, right, in the longer term. So we really need to solve some of these problems of effective facilitation. It turns out that with an effective facilitator, even people who don't know much about role-playing can successfully play this game, which is great. That's great news for us. But a facilitation tool will help people who aren't experienced role-players be effective as facilitators.
Right.
So we have a book, right, with the scenario in it that does some instructional stuff to help somebody run it. And we're also building a web app that basically provides dynamic support for somebody in running the game. So the facilitator could have a tablet at the table And the tablet, the app has a bunch of functions like, you know, here's the text that you should read. How long has this scene been going on? Here's some audio that you could play to enhance the experience. So there's a bunch of sort of features that the facilitator can use the app, even if they're not an expert role player. We hope, right? We're testing this right now to be able to run a successful game.
So this is something that at some point is going to be fairly broadly available.
That is the plan.
That's amazing.
I think that there's already been actually several stories in the press about the game. So it seems like even before it's finished and available. So it just seems like there is an interest in this. There's a hunger for it. The United States Holocaust Museum is actually already exploring what kinds of things could games teach Holocaust educators. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, we are timely, right? We are addressing a problem that at least some Holocaust educators have and are maybe providing them with new tools, right? Not just to create a great game experience for people who love role-playing games and don't mind addressing serious topics, but to actually explore some of these transformational goals for people who know more about those goals than they do about games.
Yeah. Sometimes on the show, I like to ask people how their games fight fascism, but thank you for just completely obviating and just making my question completely unnecessary. <It's> like, well.
Well, you know, and actually that's something that I really have been thinking about a lot. I just got back from the Games for Change Festival, which is a festival event. It's researchers and designers coming together to talk about games for sort of social change and social good. And I spent a lot of it going like, you know, actually, there are a lot of ways that games can fight fascism. And like, it would just be helpful to have a list. And I kind of said to myself, well, maybe I should write that because if nobody else has done that yet. I think it's an interesting question with a lot of different answers. And I think we're targeting a few of those ways. But, you know, games, despite the state of a lot of sort of social issues in gaming, games make me profoundly hopeful because games can connect people who wouldn't otherwise have a reason to connect with each other. And there are a lot of reasons why these kinds of relationships are important that have to do with access and equity, tacit distribution of tacit knowledge, access to informal networks. But one of them is just that, you know, the most consistent and effective anti-bias intervention is exposure. So spending time around people who are not just like you. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we, as with the decline of third spaces, right, there's more of the sense of like, well, I have my home, my nuclear family, and I have my work community, and we have fewer and fewer places where we can connect broadly and in unexpected ways, right? There's Robert Putnam calls it third places. And so I think games are a really critical third place. And again, I think this is part of why if we want to do anti-oppressive work with games, one of the most important things that we can do is play with people we don't know. There's lots of jokes about terrible con game experiences, and maybe that's true, right? Maybe you want to vet people before you play with them. Maybe you want to do it in a context that isn't a con. It doesn't matter. But playing or talking about games in ways that make you see people whose perspectives you might not have considered as fully human, I think that's an incredible weapon, because people will put their lives on the line for each other. I mean, that's one of the messages of Rosenstrasse. People will put their lives on the line for the people that they love. And the more opportunities we can create for people to love and know each other, mm-hmm. I think the more hope we have of creating a better world.
Oh, that's, I want to end our interview on that note because it's beautiful and very, and yes. Let's end right there. That's okay. Just too good.
You got it.
If my listeners want to keep up with you and what you're doing and what you're publishing, where is the best place for them to do that?
Yeah, I wish I had finished my academic website. It's not currently finished, but probably the best thing to do is, you know, I have a a personal website at replayable.net. That's replayable as in can be replayed. And while it's quite out of date, at bare minimum, it's got some information about my research. And, you know, as I develop my research lab's website, which is what I'm working on this summer, I'll make sure to post a link to it there. If you also, another great place to find out what I'm doing is scholar.google.com. If you search for Jessica Hammer, you'll find me. And they have a listing of everything that I've published, most of it with links to PDFs. And anything that's not up on there, you can let me know. And I can always send copies of the papers or figure out a way to get them, make them accessible online.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate you having me.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure. Remember that if you want to get in touch, you can always email me or tweet at me. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com or @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes.